is dedicated to the mastery of one Mr. Ralph Bashke.
To see here, episode 37. It's January 2017. It's a new year. It's a fresh start. What a brilliant new world we're entering. Hang on, wait, what? Oh, okay, never mind. Anyway, you're listening to See Here, episode 37. We're the podcast that discusses music-related films. If this is your first time, welcome on board. We have a back catalogue, go through them. But if you want to start from here, welcome. We're going to be talking about an interesting film tonight, today, this morning, whatever time you're listening to. But I should introduce my compadres, my co-hosts, the wonderful people on the other end of this magnificently working Skype connection. First of all, in Bath, in England, Mr. Bernard Stickwell. Good evening.
Good evening to me. Good morning to both of you, and thanks for getting up so early.
You don't know the half of it. And returned from his triumphant tour of the Antipodes, Mr. Tim Merrill over in Seoul.
Happy Australia Day.
Yeah, happy Australia Day, Morris.
Yeah, thank you. There are some people who have different political opinions about it. They call it Invasion Day, Australia Day. We're not going to go through that. We're not political here. We're musical. We're filmic. That's what we're going to do.
Well, and Morris, it's a day off work, I understand. So whatever the reason, correct, that's all good as far as I'm concerned.
Nice day to go to the pub. Nice day to go to the pub.
So what is the best thing that we could do on Australia Day? We're going to talk about a film called American Pop. Yes, folks, that's the most patriotic thing we could do today. So what we'll do is we're going to quickly go to a break and we're going to listen to the trailer for the 1981 film by Ralph Bakshi, American Pop, and then we'll be back to discuss it. You're listening to See Here.
Salmi should have been a star.
The kid's a genius.
But there were complications. Benny could have been famous, but life got in the way.
Well, it ain't no use to sin, wonder why, babe.
Tony had a brush with success.
You the one who writes the songs?
Don't you know I'm nothing without you?
But had to let it go.
I want you to play one of my songs.
So it was up to Pete to grab it, hold it, and make himself heard.
Working on a night move, trying to make some front page driving news. Working on a night move.
One family.
Some music I love.
Four generations.
This isn't work. This is play.
In love with the sound of American Pop. Ralph Bakshi, the creator of Fritz the Cat and Lord of the Rings, now takes modern animation a quantum leap forward with a motion picture of incredible beauty and remarkable power. Whether you dance to it, drive to it, sing with it, or swing with it, if you can crank it up, plug it in, or switch it on, if it assaults your senses, rocks your body, or touches your soul, it's American Pop.
Thank you. And we're back from break. Thanks so much for joining us. This is See Here, episode 37. Once again, myself here in Melbourne, Bernie over in Bath, and Tim in Seoul. And this time around, we're going to be discussing the 1981 film by one Mr. Ralph Bakshi. The film is American Pop. And just some of the IMDb details. The writer of the film was Ronnie Kern. The main voices for the film, one Mr. Ron Thompson, who plays two characters, Tony Belinsky and Pete Belinsky, Maya Small as Frankie. And actually, interesting bit of trivia, I discovered that she was Candy in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Jeffrey Lipper as Zalmi Belinsky, presumably the older Zalmi Belinsky, and Rick Singer as Benny Belinsky. IMDb lists this as the story of four generations of Russian Jewish immigrant family of musicians whose career parallels the history of American popular music in the 20th century. Okay, Tim, this was your pick. What made you pick American Pop?
Well, there were several reasons I decided to go with this one. I saw this actually back in the day of the dinosaurs with my kid brother on a Saturday afternoon. We went to the Odeon Theater back in Canada, and we saw the double bill of Ralph Bakshi's Hey Good Lookin' and American Pop. And I remember at the time, the big music, animated music movie was Heavy Metal. And that was the one that kind of got all the accolades. But I remember, you know, seeing the advertisements for this on television, and it really kind of blew my mind that, you know, they were going to go through the whole history of American rock. And I thought, man, I got to check this out, you know. So at the time, like I said, my kid brother and I had to be about, I don't know, maybe 14, 15 years old when I saw this. And it was stunning on the big screen, and it was just something that had always stuck in the back of my mind. I mean, we've got our roadmap of music films that we want to cover, and this was one that it was always kind of floating in the back there, and all of a sudden something just made it pop up again, and I thought, that's the one. And I thought that this was a film that was, it was a financial failure, but I think it's a film that needs discussion, and it's an important film to basically stand out. You know, it's a film for me that I thought is worthy of discussion.
Bernie, what did you think when you first saw this? Or was this your first viewing?
This was my first viewing. To be completely honest, I'd not even heard of this before. It's completely out of left field for me. Obviously, I know Ralph Bakshi. The only thing of his I've seen the Lord of the Rings film, which seems to get a lot of stick, but I remember quite enjoying that.
You've never seen Coonskin or...
No. I've never seen as Heavy
None
Traffic.
None of the Fritz the Cat, Heavy Traffic, and any of the Fritz, the two
I've
Fritz
seen,
films.
I think Ralph Bakshi only did one of the Fritz films, didn't he? Or did he actually do both?
I think he did the first one.
Yeah, no, I've seen the second one, but not the first one. I've seen the Nine Lives of Fritz the Cat, which I'm sure wasn't
right.
Bakshi. I've never seen Wizards. A complete blind spot for me. I mean, obviously I know of him, but I've never really kind of investigated stuff. So it was really interesting to see this.
The visual stylings that Bakshi uses in this is very comparable to another film that we covered recently, Yellow Submarine.
I'd say there's an aspect of it because there's a little bit of rotoscope that is used in Yellow Submarine, particularly I think through the Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds sequence, and there's a lot more heavy use of rotoscope.
I was thinking more along the lines of the photography. How they use photography in Yellow Submarine in the background. And,
oh, okay,
and how,
I got you, yeah.
Yeah, and how Ralph incorporates a lot of that into this film. That's what I meant, how it was comparable. Not so much the rotoscope, right, but just the way that he kind of uses history or actual figures, you know, and the back and forth.
Right. I'd say probably the major comparison between the two is that both films have an incredible visual style, someone who had an artistic vision put each one of these films together. This wasn't just sort of tailor-made for an audience. Unlike, say, like the big animated houses in America, you know, your Disneys and your Hanna-Barbera's, which were just putting things out for the Saturday morning visuals for the kids.
Yeah.
This was, Bakshi, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think was probably the only animator in America at the time who was working to make films or animated films for adults.
Right. And well, that was what I was going to say in the introduction that I neglected to do so, was the fact that the 14-year-old me that saw this was in no position to really appreciate what I was watching. You know, I mean, I was just there for the loud music and just for the popping visuals. But, you know, to go back and look at it again, it was quite a different experience.
You ain't laughing. Well, you ain't laughing because I ain't finished yet. You'll know when I'm finished, then you'll be laughing. If you ain't, then I'll be crying. That ought to be good for a few laughs.
Now, this wasn't actually my first time watching this film. Funnily enough, I think maybe it was about 3 years ago, three, 4 years ago, I'd invited Dr. Zom to come on Love That Album. You know, he'd already been on about two or three times. And he'd actually suggested that we discuss this film on the Love That Album podcast. And I went and watched it, and I don't know what happened, but, you know, we didn't end up doing that. But I did watch it back, as I said, about three, 4 years ago. And so I was sort of looking forward to having another viewing to see here to see what I thought. And I'd say that I have mixed feelings about the film. I think from a scope perspective, what Bakshi tries to do is really, really ambitious and very admirable. And visually, it's just, it's a real feast for the eyes. The artwork, the backgrounds, the background artists have done an absolutely fantastic job. And I do love the rotoscoping. I read in some reviews there were people who saw the rotoscoping as problematic and too visually distracting. I have nothing but praise for how they did that. So from a visual perspective, I'm absolutely in love with what I saw. My problem was that there's too much that they tried to fill in within a 90-minute film. This needed to be something that was, you know, if you're going to tell the story, if you're going to really give the story of these four generations, you needed like a TV miniseries, six, seven, eight hours.
Absolutely. You're right that it is almost like a miniseries. And you know what this kind of reminded me of is almost something like, even though it was a failure of a film, was that Michael Cimino film, Heaven's Gate. You know, or it almost seemed like a Godfather, like, you know, like a Coppola movie, like a mini series, or it seemed like you could have spent 10 hours telling this whole story. I could see Scorsese doing it like for HBO, like he did with the vinyl series, you know. I could totally see something like that with this.
Sure.
I think it's quite apparent that it doesn't work particularly well, not particularly well, but it doesn't kind of, it's a bit too overambitious in that respect, because he kind of focuses on one era in particular and one sort of character in particular, you know, the four generations. I felt that Benny got pretty short shrift, really, as did his father, to be honest. Zalmi. It was almost like we need to get through these little bits quickly so we can get to the point where I'm actually a bit more interested in the counterculture and what's going on and the story I kind of want to tell. So it did feel like the first two generations were kind of shortchanged a little, to me anyway.
Basically, it sounds like from your perspective, you're saying that it's less of a parallel of the complete story of 20th century pop music as more, well, let's just focus on the 60s.
Well, yeah.
To me, it's almost like an onion where, you know, at the very beginning with the rabbi, the first generation, it's like he represents kind of purity. And then his son, Zalmi, gets into the whole entertainment shtick with the chorus papers and all that. And then he becomes a little bit more dirtied, so to speak. And then his son, Benny, doesn't want any of it. And he's not a very, you know, he doesn't take any of it seriously, being an entertainer. But then his son, Tony, gets even more muddied. And then Tony's like the very end of it. And then Pete, when Pete comes out, Pete's almost muddied, but he manages to find a way to kind of go back to the music, you know? Does that make sense?
There's two interesting things about that development. You mentioned about like the pogroms that Zalmi escaped at the beginning of the film while they're still in Tsarist Russia, and his origins, Zalmi is the son of a rabbi, comes from a very Orthodox Jewish background, and then each generation gets diluted from their Judaism. And then at the very end, we get this moment where, you know, Pete is a, you know, junkie to rock musicians, and he's walking into a studio, but he sees this chassid. He's humming a tune under his breath, and then Pete stops and listens to it and sort of gives him an indication like, hey, I dig that. So there's partly about the music, but also partly about maybe it coming full circle that he discovers this spark in him about his origins. For a while, I'd sort of been thinking, well, this is a story about the parallels between 20th century America, and there are historical points which they both put in the opening credits and that they show along the way of the film, you know, the New York garment district fire disaster, World War II, all these sorts of things. So a parallel between American history and American music. But I think overall, when I sort of thought about this for a while, it's really a story about the American dream.
Right.
And, you know, you get each member of this family is, you know, they're taking a little step. So, you know, Zalmi, he loves to sing, but he gets shot in the neck during World War One and he can't sing. He can't do anything with music, but he encourages music to Benny, who becomes a great jazz player. But he goes to World War II and he can never fulfill that dream of making it big. But at least he sort of got something artistically right. And then his son, Tony, is a lyricist and he sort of has the brush with fame by being a lyricist to a band that makes it big. But then we finally get his son, Pete, who at the very end of the film, he's gone and achieved that American dream, that American success. So it's about the American dream.
He achieves that success, that American dream, by essentially being a coke dealer in the right place at the right time.
How cynical is that?
Hey, what else you got there? Songs.
You scoring songs now too?
Giving them away. A song announced.
By who?
Me.
You can keep the songs, man.
I will keep the coke too.
I have a problem, though, with is really this what three generations prior had suffered through?
Mm-hmm.
Is this what the American dream is? Not to be artistically great. It's to have millions of screaming kids worshiping you while you prance around the state.
But I think it's different for everybody, right? What everybody was chasing was a different end game. Pete saw where Tony came from, and he saw, like, at the very end, like, there's a line where he says, for 3 years, I've been fetching for you guys and I've been hustling and doing all this shit. I'm done. I want it now. Like, you know, all he wants is them to just listen to him play his song. That's kind of the thing that goes back to Zalmi, where Zalmi is like, give me a chance. When he's up there singing, when he's the grown-up baby kid with the hat, he's already, you know, too old. It's like, nah, give him a chance, you know, like, let's see what he can do, you know. And I think in the end, that's kind of like Pete. There's a parallel to that where Pete's just kind of like, look, you know, if you don't want to let me play one song, then I'm going to take my blow and I'm going to split. And they're like, no, man, don't split. He's like, you know, there's an interesting thing. I mean, Pete's not looking for, you know, the multi-million. He just says one song, just listen to my song, you know. And it's the same thing because first he's denied by Tony. You know, when he's sitting there on the bench with Tony and he goes, you know, it'd be nice if you listen to my music once in a while or give me some pointers. And Tony keeps saying, go back to Kansas.
Yeah.
Go back to Kansas, you know. And then he, you know, and to add insult to injury, he goes and hawks Pete's fucking guitar. And then he disappears and he's gone. And then the guy shows up with a big bag of dope. He says to Pete, here, man, don't sell it all in one place, you know?
Well, it's different for each generation, as Tim
That's
said,
what I'm saying.
Isn't it? Yeah, yeah. The kind of goalpost shift and what people would sort of deem as success in the 70s or early 80s is different to what his great-great-grandfather was kind of struggling for and aiming for and hoping for. I think it does a fairly good job of showing that.
I'm just sort of concerned, though, that the very end, and I don't know, maybe it's just a thing that I have with the values of it. It's saying, right, well, we're going to celebrate Pete's success and this is the American dream and isn't it great? Rather than there's nothing like a little hint of irony saying, right, well, this is what you were working towards.
Absolutely. And yeah. No, I understand that, Morris. I can absolutely see that point of view.
Enlisted. What do you mean you enlisted?
I like the hat, Pops.
Hey, Benny, you got a wife now. You got a kid coming.
So? Need a steady job.
What are you talking, a steady job? You got a steady job here.
No, Pops. This isn't work. This is play.
In a film like this, we're sort of juxtaposing real events in American history, and they're using a lot of music. I think there's something like 50 songs that we hear in part or in full throughout the course of the film to illustrate the history of American music. And then when we get to the whole point of Tony being a lyricist for this band, they're rewriting history.
Right.
You know, Tony's not coming up with new songs, or the writers of the film are not coming up with new songs. All of a sudden, this band is the one that has gone and written Grateful Dead's Somebody to Love.
When the truth is found to be.
They're the ones who have written Hard Rain by Bob Dylan. And later on, Pete is the one who's written Bob Seger's Night Moves. And if Ralph Bakshi had had his way, it would have been Freebird, but they couldn't afford it.
Well, Freebird's actually at the end of the
film. I was going to say, doesn't it play over the credits at the end?
Yeah.
Yeah. As I understood it, the actual songs you hear in the films are the original songs by the original artists.
There's this moment where you see the band rehearsing doing Hard Rain.
Yeah.
Right.
And get your shit together, guys. This isn't good enough. And it's really her singing.
It's a really interesting conceit to have the original songs by the original artist, but in the narrative of the film, they're being performed by somebody else. As a kind of rights issue as well. I don't know whether this film is actually even available through sort of normal means these days. I don't know whether...
No, it's not.
I don't know whether that's a music rights thing.
Well, they said, apparently, because Bakshi had been held in high regard because of his earlier films, he managed to get the rights to a lot of these songs rather cheaply, and people who would have normally said, nah, you've got to pay through the nose, said, no, we respect your art, that's fine, you can have our song. But it took, like, I think until 1998 before the film was available on home video.
I was going to say with the band, you know, one thing that I found interesting is, I mean, they could have shown Tony writing for so many different acts. But I think the thing is they were trying to just keep it, rein it in and focus on just, you know, the relationship with him and the girl and the band. And the band was like, you know, an amalgamation of the Jefferson Airplane and the Dead and Janis Joplin and all of it. I mean,
she was very definitely kind of Janis Joplin and maybe a bit of Slick or someone.
Absolutely. I mean, I understand why they did it the way they did it. And again, like you were saying, Bernie, about how music being played in different ways, like original music, how did you guys feel about that? I mean, like, I thought there was a couple of things that I really, really liked. Like, for example, the Pat Benatar Hell is for Children, when he's just walking down the street throwing out bags of dope to people. Yeah, I thought that was kind of cool, the way that came across. And I've also got to admit, I love the way that he did Night Moves with the piano. Where he's just, like, I just thought, like, that was amazing, the way they really pulled that off. Even though, you know, I'm not the greatest Bob Seger fan, but I just thought that was really neat, the way they, and the way that they show the guys up in the booth, and they're like, okay. And then you see the tape start rolling, and then you see him on the phone, and then it's just like, oh, yeah, you know, it's on.
I have no problem with telling a fictitious story within the real world. I mean, that's what film and literature is all about. But where you start sort of combining a film that has acknowledgement of real artists and then rewriting history to say, well, we're going to pretend that these other real artists like Dylan and the Jefferson Airplane didn't exist, and we're going to amalgamate them into this fictitious band. That, I don't know. I'm not sure I'm crazy about that level of story, right?
But I kind of know what you're saying, Morris, but if they hadn't used original songs and then basically just got a group or some musicians together to kind of do facsimiles of songs from that period, then I think the film probably would have suffered because of it. It's difficult to say, but I'd rather it was the original songs, even tweaked in the narrative sense.
It goes back to what we were talking about, your place one day, Morris, about, you know, when you present history, you know, in a media format, the minute you're trying to, you know, get people interested or entertain them, then the history loses its legitimacy. For every, even a simple documentary that's straight ahead, you know, and 100% factual, still edits the film, it still, you know, adds soundtracks, it still adds, you know, narrators. In so many ways, it's really hard to accurately just present straight up history, you know, and if you're going to do entertainment, then you have to throw out the legitimacy all straight out of it. I mean, mean, mm-hmm. you know, you can't have 100% straight legitimacy in any of it. I mean, so I think that's, you have to take it for what it is. It's art.
Yeah.
But it's not a straight presentation of history.
I am going to make one more little gripe, one more little quip, and this is being nitpicky, but another issue that I have with the film is timeline. And you're never quite sure when they skip from one era to the next, not really quite sure at first where they are. And when they move straight into the section with Tony as a grown-up, so like when he's in the beatnik era, and you hear in the background of the opening shot just before we see Tony as a grown-up, you hear in the background some radio about the Julius and Ethel Rosenberg trial.
Right, right.
And they were executed in 1953. And the music you hear in the background is Herbie Hancock's Cantaloupe Island. Released from 1964, and you figure it's one thing where you're using music to set a mood, but if you're going to be historically, you know, even historically rough, you know, give it a year or two, I'm not going to be fussy ever if you have music from 1954 when it's 1953. That's okay, but you know, you're going 11 years hence, you would have thought, you know, just
yeah,
I know they're trying to be artistically correct, but right. also you might as well be historically correct.
Sure. Well, that's it. It wouldn't have been difficult to pick something from that period to put.
Sure.
There, I just thought it was a scene, would it? Yeah.
Consider it like this, too. I just listened to somebody say something recently that even autobiographies are never 100% accurate because we're basing it all on memory. And our memories are really faulty, too, right? So, I mean, if you look at the film, almost like somebody recalling a time. Like, you know, almost like somebody saying, yeah, I remember this and I remember that. But they don't remember it exactly the way things ever really went down. You know what I mean? Like, there's always that error or that kind of misunderstanding.
The further away you get from an incident, it becomes right. the thing in your head. Right. And the, you know, right. as opposed to the actual incident, your right. memory of that incident isn't necessarily. It's like this, the Rashomon thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. There's nothing else in this film that speaks of an unreliable narrator.
No, that's
and
true. Yeah.
That was just I don't know, just one little sloppy bit right. for me.
Well, I think that's, as you were saying earlier, Morris, I think it tries to encompass a little bit too much. Its scope is too wide, and because of that, there are a few little sloppy mistakes and errors and right. corners that were cut.
You sing?
No.
You play guitar?
No.
Everybody plays guitar, man. Everybody plays a guitar.
Hey, man, what do you do?
I write songs.
All right. Words and music.
Words. I don't know nothing about no music.
Yeah, we can see that.
One thing I wanted to touch on before I forget is the actual art of this film. And I have to say that there are moments in this film, especially in the beginning, that are just absolutely gorgeous.
Yep.
There are points in this film that, correct me if I'm wrong, or I don't know if you guys would get the same vibe, but it really looked like to me like the art of like Degas and Chagall. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of almost like points of where I saw things that reminded me of classical pieces, you know? Yeah, I just thought it was just absolutely astounding the way, and even the way they were to incorporate, it looked like almost like watercolors, and then it looked yeah. like oils, and yeah. then it looked like, you know, like, it was just phenomenal, and just the level of care that they put into putting it on the screen like that is just phenomenal.
Oh, there's no doubt that the visuals of this were made with a hell of a lot of love, and really, I think that he's gone and thrown down his scope or his, you know, his ambition right from the opening credits, where you get these moments of, you get like these still paintings or drawings of moments in American history, be it the landing on the moon, be it Watergate, World War II, all these visuals mixed in with paintings of great musical moments in 20th yes, century yeah, yeah. America. And that takes on a different visual style from, I think, a lot of what else that we see in the film. So he's come up with something seriously beautiful. This really is art. And another thing where I'm guessing that this is due to the rotoscoping, I've not been a comic book reader in many, many years. So forgive me if I'm out of line, if I'm wrong about this, but it seemed to me that a lot of what I saw here in terms of the way how the characters spoke or expressions on their face looked like what I would see in a comic book rather than what I'm typically used to in other American animation of the time. What you'd see in a more realistic, inverted commas, looking Hanna-Barbera cartoon, which just always looked like a cartoon. In comic books, they're always going for something, or at least the ones that I remember, look like they're going for something more realistic or more...
Well, I think Bakshi, I mean, obviously, he came to prominence during that kind of counterculture period of the late 60s into the 70s. And if you look at his body of work, all his films have definitely got that sort of comic booky vibe.
Right. Mm.
So there's definitely a correlation between what he was doing and what the sort of underground people were doing. You know, you have Robert Crumbs and Gilbert Shelton with Freak Brothers and so on. And even the more kind of you look at Wizards or something like that, I assume not having seen that, but a big sort of Vaughn Bode influence there. Richard Corbin, all those guys who were kind of,
right,
as he was in his way redefining and experimenting with animation,
right,
these guys were doing the same thing in comic books, and you can tell they were the same period and they were taking from each other and incorporating that, you know? So I think you're actually spot on there, Morris. I think that's a definitely valid point.
And you know, now that I think about it, Bernie, this whole film is almost like the graphic novel before the graphic novel.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
This is, no, it really, the way they incorporate the boxes and the little sketches and like all of this is like it's like a graphic novel before the graphic novel.
I was going to say it's almost a mixed media kind of approach, not quite mixed media, but variations on the same thing and different moods created by different styles of artwork or coloring, or it's definitely all there.
I also want to mention that I like the way how he frames a lot of his shots, because he's actually framing it like a filmmaker who just happens to be working in the animated medium. So, for instance, I want to sort of talk about a couple of scenes in particular that I found impressive in that way. There's one scene which I like visually. I get a bit of a creepy vibe from it, even though it's supposed to be romantic, but I get a creepy vibe from it otherwise. But visually, there's the scene where Zalmi, he's in the vaudeville theater. He's backstage. He's dressed like a clown, and he goes to Bella, the stripper's costume changing room, and he approaches her, and then we see his face, the look on her face, and they're basically mentally seducing each other. And then you see a shot of his face, a shot of her face, a shot of his pants dropping, and then it goes straight to the dancing girls on the vaudeville stage. And that's something that's, I think he's really thought this out very well from a visual perspective, from a framing perspective. I hate to sort of be making the distinction between a filmmaker and an animator, but if you're comparing for the time what maybe Disney or Hanna-Barbera, and I hate to sort of make that comparison, but that's what was happening in American animation. And I don't think they would have ever gone and thought about framing their shots in that way. It was, this is what animation does and this is what cinema does. But Bakshi was thinking very much
in a
non-animated
filmmaker director. Mm. So I love visually that style. You know, you see his eyes, her eyes, his legs, her undoing the strap on her shoes.
Right.
Just these little touches.
There's a real tenderness in a lot of the film, you know, like in points with the animation, you know, like even though, you know, it's hard and, you know, and sometimes, you know, like the characters are deplorable, sometimes there's like a real tenderness to it.
I think as well that that scene, and there's a couple of other scenes throughout the film, it's kind of a mission statement. It's there to sort of remind you, actually, no, this isn't Disney. This is a grown-up animated film. This is a sophisticated film, and we're going to throw things like this in there because this is how you need to approach watching the film, you know?
Here's something I noticed, too, that was interesting, is that they actually used real character actors as models for the people in the film. And I don't know if you guys are familiar or you know the name Vincent Schiavolo.
Yeah, he's a, yeah, I know. He, yes, yep.
He's a character actor. It kind of looks like a bloodhound. He had that long, droopy face. He was really famous character actor with a long face. You'd know him to see him. Anyways, I spotted him in this film. He's one of the
Was he the one in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, I know exactly who. You mentioned the droop face. I know exactly who you're talking about.
He's in this film. He's one of the characters. I mean, it was, I think it was Zalmi's dad when he's talking to him there in front of one of the clubs.
At the start, Right. Yeah.
Because I'm going, holy shit, that's Vincent Schiavone. Yeah. So I thought it was kind of neat how they kind of, you know, used actual people as models. Like, that was kind of a cool move.
Well, apparently, yeah. I was reading on IMDb, some of the rotoscoping they actually did with scenes from other movies. There's a dance scene at the start. I think it's when he's dancing with Bella, is it?
Right.
Is apparently Jimmy Cagney and someone else from... There we go. Rotoscope footage of James Cagney and Gene Harlow dancing from the 1931 film The Public Enemy is included in the ballroom dance scene when Belle is singing Bill. Huh. So how about that? That's crazy, isn't it?
Yep. I mean, they also used a lot of the main voices in there. They did their own rotoscoping for them too. So I think when they said the main voice of Tony and Pete, Ron Thompson, he said, you know, there's that moment in the film where he's jumping carriages on the train, which made me think of Bound for Glory. But he said, like, they got him set up in a real studio and he was jumping over planks to simulate what they would then put in the drawing of him jumping carriages in the train. So there's a lot of their own rotoscoping, but it's interesting that you said that they stuff from other films.
I think it's only a couple of scenes they used it from. They used it during, but I got to say as well, I mean, harking back to what we were talking about earlier and just the animation in general, I love the rotoscope in this. I think it works really, really well. And it's just something you don't ever see it anymore.
A lot of people see it as cheating. Like, there's a lot of, you hear a lot of naysayers that say that, you know, it's almost like Batsky, he traced. He kind of had the training wheels on, but it's like, no, he didn't. I mean, like, I would like to see somebody actually try to animate rotoscope. Like, try and do what he does. You can't do that. Like, I mean,
plus it's, it's a tool that, you know, the animator uses to get where he wants to go with the film. And, you know, how is that different to any other?
Well, the funny thing is today is everybody relies on CGI. And everybody says, oh, well, you know, you got to be technical with CGI. You got to have skill. But then they laugh and they look at rotoscope and say, what is this shit?
Yeah.
And that's where a lot of people actually went after Ralph for The Lord of the Rings. I mean, when he put that film out, everyone said, oh, that looks like shit, right? But then they look at what Peter Jackson's done with the CGI and with all that that 4K, the sped up film that he was doing. And everyone says, oh, that's gorgeous. And it's just like, no.
No, that looks like shit.
You know, one thing was done by hand. I mean, back in the day, that was all manual.
Even if it is cheating in inverted commas or however you want to approach it, there's a certain level of craft that goes along with that is different to just kind of knowing how to code CGI these days. Well, I don't know. Maybe they're different skills, aren't they? But
I definitely appreciate, though, that what they have come up with here is it's art.
Yeah.
It's just – so if nothing else, I mean, like, you know, okay, let's forget for a sec the rotoscoping of the characters in the foreground. But if you're looking at, like, scenes in the Vaudeville Theatre with the crowd or moments during World War II is – all the background stuff would have been done by background artists. That would have all been hand-drawn. And, you know, they remain still while stuff moves in the foreground. But so they're combining all this. And there's real art that's going on there. And that's just, I don't know, it really annoys me to think that people were giving Bakshi crap for presenting
it like that. I agree. I think so, it's beautiful,
For all the narrative problems that I think the film has, and I think there are a lot, but as something to just watch, it is definitely impressive. Right. I just want to make mention of one more scene that I thought worked really well in the film, and I'd be surprised if it wasn't in your list of favorite scenes as well. And that the one where, you know, Benny, he's out on the battlefield in World War II and he's walking through bombed out area, enters this house and sees a piano, and he gets this pangs to start playing the piano again. He thinks, oh wow, I'm far from home, I might as well just playing this piano. And there's that German soldier who comes out of the rubble.
Thank you. bunker.
And sees him, and Benny catches sight of him and then starts changing it to a German tune. And the German soldier sways back and forth, and for a moment, they're sort of joined by the power of music, and the German soldier says, Dunker, and then proceeds to kill him. It's visually impressive, but it's a really emotional moment.
Right. Well, that's what I was trying to say earlier about these tender moments in the film. You know, these moments that are very heartfelt. I mean, like, there's also the bit where when Pete's the kid and then they wind up in Kansas with the band. And Pete comes sniffing around and he says, you know, yeah, like, you know, like my dad, I don't know anything about my dad. And then all of a sudden Tony's just like, Kansas.
Yeah.
It's like, oh shit. Or when they're sitting on the bench and Tony gives him Benny's harmonica.
Belong to my father. I'm giving it to you.
Why?
What the hell do you think?
Yeah.
And, you know, like there's just little things that really, you know, are really heartfelt in this film.
I like that scene where Pete kind of comes out the shop with some groceries and he comes over the road up into the apartment and he gets some cornflakes ready for Tony, and Tony's like, oh, I don't want no fucking cornflakes. It's just it's just a really nice little, I mean there's no need for that to be in there other than to give the characters some depth and a connection. And
this is going to sound weird, but I got just at that one moment, I got a complete Joe Buck and Ratso Rizzo.
Yeah,
sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I like at the end, you know, where you see Pete when he's grown up and he still has that bag of groceries and he goes back and he winds up opening up the piano and dumping all that stuff into the piano.
That's right. Right.
Okay, so any more thoughts overall about the film? Any highlights? Any other qualms you haven't mentioned till now?
One thing I have to say, and I have to give the utmost respect and ultimate props to Ralph Bakshi, because here's a guy through his whole career that made a whole absolute lifetime career of kicking against the pricks. Here's a guy who had a vision to make Fritz the Cat, you know, despite all these people saying, no, you can't do that, you can't do that. And he says, just watch me, you know. And then doing Heavy Traffic and Coonskin. All the films that he's made have never been commercially successful. Even when he was in Hollywood, he did Cool World with Brad Pitt and Kim Basinger. That was as high as he went, but it still wasn't a commercial success. But Ralph didn't care. I mean, he's done television with Mighty Mouse. He's done a number of videos. Ralph did a video for Paula Abdul. And
didn't he do the one with when she's dancing with the cat?
That's the one I'm talking about.
I didn't realize that was him. Okay.
Yeah, I think he did that. And like there was, you know, he's done so many different things as an artist. And, you know, and today in this day and age, a lot of people would say that you're not successful until you've made it, you know, until, you know, you're recognized, until you're a household name and all these other trappings and bullshit. But Ralph is an artist first and foremost, and he's a guy that's always stuck to his guns. And with this project, this is just an absolutely beautiful work of art that it's not for everybody. And I have to give props to Columbia too for putting this out at the time, because I mean, it's not really for kids, but then I don't see a lot of adults wanting to go see this either, right?
That's it. It's amazing to think that somebody would have greenlit this thinking, yeah, there's an audience for this out there somewhere,
right? Because of heavy metal. And other things.
Yeah.
I mean, let's just say that film, by some miracle, had been made today. Because, you know, nowadays, I mean, there's still obviously a lot of animation for kids. But the idea of animation for adults is probably less foreign than it was in 1980. Even despite the fact that Bakshi had a history of making films for adults over the previous 10 years. But now that adult animation is seen as more of a thing, would a film like this have been more successful in 2017?
I could see this being an actual series or something, like through Adult Swim or some type of cable. Like, for there's all kinds of animation now that is really highbrow. And I mean, and I'm not talking motion pictures. I'm talking like for television, you know, or internet series. I could see this being a series. I really could.
I was going to say that that's the thing. I don't know whether it would work as a movie, as a theatrical kind of release, but certainly, like you're saying, Tim, in another kind of medium, online, TV, whatever, I think something like this would probably work really well. Yeah.
Imagine if Ralph had done the whole history of American pop in like 10-minute little bites on YouTube. Yeah, it would be like, okay, here we are about Hendrix, here we are about this point, here we are about punk, and then they just do these 10-minute little vignettes, you know, like that. That, you know, that would be incredible. And then they'd be able to put it all out on a Blu-ray, and you could just play them right from the beginning and go through. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'd buy that.
All right. So basically, you know, once again, from my perspective, I agree with you both that, you know, visually magnificent plot, somewhat overarching, even through its lack of character development or not giving us enough story. I don't think that story-wise is a failure, but probably, you know, as you've just been saying, Tim, it warrants a mini series, you know, or these 10-minute segments. That's another approach. But if it had just been done as is, but padded out for, you know, 8-10 hours to give a much more comprehensive story, you get much more of a feel for the characters following their journey over a longer period of time.
Right.
But with, you know, this some great level of plot development, and it could have been a really great success. So,
well, here's something to consider. If this ever gets released to Blu-ray, I'm hoping that maybe there's a possibility. And I know Basquiat he's notorious for leaving a lot, doing more than less, and it would not surprise me if this ever gets released to Blu-ray that there is additional footage.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the hoping somebody like Arrow or one of these kind of boutique labels in the future could ever put this out, because I would love to see a high definition version of this film. Like, that would
look
just
amazing, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah. Shit. I mean, I got lucky enough to see this on the big screen, like 35, when I was a kid. And that was stunning. I mean, in my local little theater in my hometown. But again, like I said, at that age, I really couldn't appreciate what I was watching. I timed the past 2 hours on a Saturday afternoon with my kid brother, you know?
I enjoyed it. It's certainly flawed. I think it's a little overambitious, but the concept is great, and the execution is, you know, it's almost there. It's kind of 80% there, I think, and it's certainly worth checking out. Whether you were a fan of music, or, well, one would assume you would be listening to this podcast, but or just a fan of animation, or just something that, you know, is definitely got that, despite the kind of sweeping history it tries to cover, it definitely has a sort of counter-culture-y sort of vibe to it.
So, right.
And if you've got an interest in that kind of thing as well, it's definitely worth a look. So, flawed, but interesting, definitely.
Can we tell people where to find this if they want to watch it?
Absolutely. This is on Vimeo. I know that there are some people who sort of say, oh, you know, have a problem with, you know, looking at films on sites like YouTube and Vimeo, but if you can find somewhere like a DVD copy that you can buy, go for it. But if you can't, it's on Vimeo.
Right. And we'll post a link. We'll post a link with the show notes, and you'll be able to find it.
We will. Okay, so the way how 2017 is going to map out, I put up a post a few weeks ago asking for requests from the listenership. So we have 4 film requests coming up over the air, and we'll be discussing those, and hopefully we might even get some of our requesters to come and join us for those discussions. Always welcome. But next month will be our choice, or in particular, I should say, Bernie, your choice for February. What have you got
just
for
us? Just little old me, just my choice.
Just your choice. I mean, we serve our listenership.
Of course, of course.
We serve our listenership.
Well, it's apt that you bring up the requests, because this one was actually suggested by somebody after the requests had closed.
Okay.
But it was one that I've kind of had on my list for a while. So this is one that Rodrigo mentioned. So he'll be happy to hear that next month we're going to cover the 1973 film Payday, featuring Rip Torn as a outlaw country type singer, and all the whiskey women womanizing and misery that brings, I guess. So okay. 1973's Payday.
Was this the one, I think, during the shooting of this, where he got into that fight with Norman Mailer?
I don't know. Possibly. I don't know.
Have you ever seen the footage of that with him and Mailer getting into it?
No.
Oh, it's craziness.
Well, who won?
We'll get in it. Well, I'll let you watch it on YouTube. Rip Torn and Norman Mailer.
Why? Huh.
I don't even remember that request. I don't think I've heard of this one. So, okay, looking forward to checking it out. Okay, so Payday from 1973, and that'll be episode 38 in February. It will be the film that we'll discuss. So looking forward to your company then. Just some quick housekeeping details. If you want to join our Facebook group, and why not? We're all friendly people, and we'd love to hear more suggestions from you or some feedback about the show or just some general discussion about music-related films. We'd love to hear from you. So you can find us at facebook.com/groups/seehere podcast. You can email us at seehere podcast@gmail.com. That's S-W-H-E-A-R. You obviously know that anyway because you've gone and downloaded this show, but just sort of get that out there. I think that pretty much covers all the housekeeping stuff. So we're a monthly podcast. If this is your first time listening to us, just be aware we do this once a month. Don't be looking for us every week because, frankly, we're all pretty lazy. But once a month we can manage, and we hope that we can count on your listenership. Please spread the word that we exist. As well as getting us from iTunes, you can also find us at seehere.podbean.com, any of your other favorite podcast catching applications.
And before I forget, I'd like to wish all our listeners and our new listeners a happy new 2017, health and happiness to everyone.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it can't be worse than last year.
Oh, dear, why am I laughing?
Because otherwise you'd be crying.
Don't want to do that. Okay, so until next time, watch some great movies, listen to some great music, and just generally be nice to each other. We need it more than ever. Okay, yep. So we'll see you in February 2017. All the best. Cheers.
Cheers.
Bye.
This is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.